So I was told that I should lead this discussion about how LIGO and other, you know, observatories, observations, etc., can help us in discriminate different models. So, and we've heard, you know, many things this morning. You know, people are talking about, you know, rates that we can use, just simply the number of systems that we observe. Everybody's going back to this idea of spins. I would like to remind everyone that what Ben and Richard already said, that spins are hard to measure. We do not know what nature is going to throw us, but the spin measurement is difficult. And we have a selection effect in the binaries we are more sensitive to. That is that we are more sensitive to binaries that are essentially face-on, where therefore, even if there is precession, these modulation effects are smaller at the detector output. Ben had a very nice illustration of all this morning. So I really hope we will see some you know, very interesting outliers there. I'm sure we will. But this will not be the, you know, the sort of standard attack we will make. I also want to comment on you know, sky localization, because there is a lot of discussion about, you know, Virgo coming online, and therefore our sky localization will become a factor of 5 to 10 better. I really hope that's the case. However, I think we should be sufficiently realistic. You know, Virgo is lagging a science run and a half behind LIGO in commissioning. Most of the events will be at detection threshold, and therefore Virgo will contribute little in the localization of these things. And we are talking about, you know, 100 or 500 square degrees in the sky for something that is a 500 megaparsec or a gigaparsec. So I think, yes?
What is the fraction that LIGO will only detect? What is the fraction that LIGO will detect
divided by the number that LIGO will detect? So it will, so I think guessing, this depends on what is the actual sensitivity of Virgo. And I think, guessing what is the sensitivity of Virgo right now, after three failures of you know, fibers, etc., is a big ask. But, pardon?
So from the first two-year study, which turns out was an optimistic view for what Virgo will do, it was about a 50% dual detection triple time.
That's correct. And the one that are sub-threshold in Virgo would still help in scale localization, but not as much as you would. No, it's just the, I mean, here the statement is the relative sensitivity between the two instruments. Okay. That's right. So, I mean.
So, but sorry, just that, I mean, not to, but even a little SNR from Virgo, SNR 4 compared to 8 or 12 on the others, helps somewhat with localization. It's not as dramatic, you might, but it's not as useless as the, in your square root, some squares, the SNR 4 sounds completely useless. You still get something just from timing.
Yeah, but this will affect less than 50% of the detections. And probably the increasing localization is going to be a factor of 2 rather than, you know, 5 or 10. But it depends a lot of on the details. So, yeah, we just don't know. We just have to see. So I think 100 square degrees is going to be a pretty standard number. Let's put it this way. This is my gut feeling.
Yeah,
Okay.
Are you being a bit pessimistic with respect to the speed? So we mentioned what we heard this morning. What the frequency at which they merge and the final speed already tells you quite a bit. And then once black hole and stars come online, then you're also going to get a very interesting handle there.
Pardon?
Or you're maybe thinking of fire.
You mean studying these prior with the difference of magnitude? I've complained about this before, right?
Yeah, I know.
The spins could be large, and it could be very different.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is that we, on average, you know, our ability of recovering spin is going to be sufficiently poor. Of course, you know, for a black hole neutron star system, which is sufficiently close, then we should be able to read very well the spins, very well. Okay. At least constrains the spins to be above, 0.1 at 90% or 95%. This would be my guess. But it depends so much on, I mean, your ability to measure these things really depend on what are actually the parameters in the signal that you observe. And in particular, really, what is the tilt angle, and then what is your viewing angle for that particular binary. So it's very hard to give you a generic statement there.
What about Kagura? The
Chi parameter?
Kagura.
Kagura. No, yeah, of course. Yeah, no, so I'll get to that point in a second. So, I mean, and then the other final thing, people talk about eccentricity. Okay, I am, again, skeptical there to be able to put significant constraints on the eccentricity. I think we shouldn't talk about, you know, Lisa observation in 2034 or so right now. But, okay, maybe we can do something with the eccentricity, but I think it's going to be very, very hard to put a meaningful limit. Okay, yes. Sure. Yeah. So, okay. So, consider that these are fantastic observations, but there are challenges to, you know, read out the parameters with, finite signal to noise ratio, etc. So one question, and it's something that we have been discussing at the end of Stroud's talk or discussion, is tests. Can we, for each of these models, each of them right now are, let's say, all in play to explain at least 50% or 100% of this of this detection, and the question is whether we can come up with the, you know, definitive observation that people that have been working on model, you know, ABC, whatever it is, will say, I'm out of the game, okay? My model is dead at this point. Yeah, so for example, if you take dynamical, formation in, clusters, is there, if we see a signal or some distribution in the population, whatever you guys want to sign up for, that has a particular distribution, for example, we can tell you that all the spins are always parallel to the orbital angular momentum, then those people will say, I'm out. I mean, this, I cannot explain this. And the question is, can we write down what these tests are? And the other question, which I think is important, I mean, for deciding whether there is something we can do to affect the science we'll be doing later, is that, is there something, I don't know, from the data analysis point of view or for the instrumental upgrades point of view that we can do in order to, really get a better handle in the science. For example, I'm just, saying something crazy, there are, I don't know, $300 million for incremental upgrades of LIGO. Do we want to spend this money on the 500 to 1 kilohertz frequency? Do we want to go down to lower frequencies? Or do we want to give this money to the Indians, the Italians, French, and the Japanese to have their instruments up and running at a, you know, comparable sensitivity so that we can have a 5 detector network and we go down to 1 square degrees in the sky? Okay. Or actually, there is, you know, this morning Luis was talking about the possibility of doing real-time alerts. Is it something we should really think about, because it is going to be critical? Okay, so I know that Cheryl has got ideas about the test of the models, but there are. Absolutely. I mean, and we should think about the other constraints that will come in the next 5 to 10 years. Absolutely. Yeah, I
suppose you had 1,001-degree air boxes. That's the effect of common damper for 10 years. Did nothing except for they were cosmological, which was very useful. Actually, nobody should cosmological.
Yeah.
What would it tell you?
No. So essentially, we will, you know, produce a, I don't know, d of n, dm1, dm2, or I should put, yeah, d chi a, and dz. Fine. Okay. So that's surely what we can do. Oh, for, I don't know, 100, 200, 300, whatever it is, the number of events.
It's clear to me that if the spins are large, there's great diagnostic power. If it ends up that they're all 0.1, because every star in binary, non-binary, and the spectacular magnetic wave, platelets,
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we, I mean, these are the kind of things that we are working on, you know, to. So this one is something that we have on our laptops, I guess. So, yeah, with different prescriptions, and then we can talk about the fancy statistics, etc. But that's exactly, you know, what is being done.
Concentration of mass ratio equal one systems and very fine tuned to one as well. So I think if you see such a concentration, that's something that's very hard to explain in algorithms.
So
not so much as looking for an observation that rules out something, but observations that essentially should we expect them to come from one channel.
So if we see a mass ratio that is less than, I don't know, 0.1, for example, for that specific event, you would be saying, I cannot explain it.
Yeah.
That would be a test. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So the common envelope evolution here is a super simple model. The one, well, few more, but one key parameter there is just how efficiently you are overrides orbital energy injecting the envelope. You can assign a value for that. And there's a beautiful test coming from the whole wide world systems, binaries that are here in our lab. But so one of the trouble here that you hit is that it's clear that the one parameter doesn't capture all the physics that's going on. And so, yes, you can calibrate that alpha. Planetary nebula, and I think we 0.2, so we cover it. So why are we not using that from now on? Because we're not sure that this higher mass regime, for example, maybe all effects join and tell us basically it's alpha model as well. So we have different tests constraining it, but we don't even believe that the constraints from here help us over there. So that goes back to what Matteo was trying to state, I think, is to what extent can we go for a more physical model of just this alpha that still parameterized in a simple way, but in a way we can be capturing these, for example, mass dependence that might be there possible.
Just to add on to that, so you know, when you're looking at uncertainties in common envelope evolution, the big focus is always on the efficiency alpha. But there's other parameters at play. A key one is, when does a common envelope even actually happen when you really get unstable mass transfer? To look at the low mass regime, you know, when you're calibrating against one of yours, take a Meson model of a red giant. Start peeling mass off at 10 to the negative 3 solar masses per year. Conventional wisdom would be, oh, this is going to puff up, right? Because you're pulling off of the envelope. Except you're not pulling off of this deep convex envelope. You're pulling off of that cool super adiabatic layer. The thing will not radically expand. You might not even get rapid acceleration of mass loss. If you try to look at this, it doesn't behave, whether you get unstable mass transfer or not, it doesn't seem to behave as a simple mass ratio cutoff or following what you would expect from analysis of quality. This is a big problem. When does the common envelope even actually happen? It's the initial conditions, not just numerical simulation of this in spiral.
Well, so that's something that we can actually constrain with the rules we have now.
Maybe constrain for double and dwarf state, but
I know, I mean theoretically, you can improve on the constraint that now. You can mold the, as you said, mold the mass of the response.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You can have the populations.
Yeah, exactly. That's the key. All of these conversions with population synthesis that use these simple mass ratio cutoffs.
But I think it's, you know, the way cell spreads into what Alec just said are going in the right direction, because I think it's clear from what we said this morning, which is that it's going to be hard to say, you know, with individual detections or with specific detections, you know, where the null on any given common envelope, blah, 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 100 nulls, and it will go from 0 to 11. And any specific, so, you know, what are the key questions, like, you know, if we see something with eccentricity, does that definitely mean we're seeing dynamical capture? Or are there supernova kick models that could give you some eccentric values, some mass ratio? So if you see, you know, a 20-20 that's eccentric, 20 solar that's eccentric, then you've probably seen a dynamical capture scenario, because a 20 solar black hole is going to form a system that doesn't give you a big kick. So, or is there some...
I mean, if we see a 20 or 30 in the LIGO band, and we can say it's eccentric, the eccentricity must be 0.2. Or something. At that point, I think it's only dynamics.
Exactly. Right. So
I would say.
Yeah. Because then, you know, if you can get these both, and there's both positive and negative, right? Because then, you know, you can say we see something's not resolved the chemical homogeneous evolution, so there'll be other channels of work. You can't say there's other channels of work, there must be other channels of work. I think that's, and then you can say, it's better if you say, yes, it must definitely come from this channel, but I think you can still get information from building up the, you know, it's something other than this, so...
Absolutely. I'm also wondering, if you could address... You mentioned there's a time of time and time consistency is only one side of the matter that you have is training or overcast questions. This is not how it will be in the future. We could probably have a variety of cases that differences.
No, but the idea is...
outliers that say don't overlap, so you know that perhaps there's some region of the mass and redshift parameter space that two models cover very well, and perhaps chemically inhomogeneous or homogeneous evolution doesn't. Then, you that already starts to sort of limit, at least on those cases, what fraction is coming from one model and what fraction isn't.
And I think it's really important that you do that after also varying the model.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the absence, you want
the space that we predict.
You want these as functional outputs, basically. You want some large, almost fitted formula where you can dial the knobs inside, and that will readjust that distribution. You then just add them together, and then and essentially, then you just have a giant parameter estimation
problem. And so, so I don't think it's asking, you know, provoke the question, saying, you know, for a given model, survey the landscape, and all this looking comes to that model. If everything looks blurry, then okay, there's not much you can do. But if there's some feature that is definitive of that model, then you can go after it, like eccentricity.
I mean, if we want really to make progress, we will need to have a way of exploring the parameter space and either rule out, well, the only thing we can do is rule out. Okay, so it's...
But just to be clear, that is a very hard problem. Tripping all the maps and figuring out the optimal possible
solution.
Oh, yeah, it's very tough to explain.
That
2,000
models,
So do you, Sterl, do you want to go through? You wrote it down, but I think we should go through each of these points. Okay. Shall we go through? Okay. Sterl, do you wanna go through number one and see whether there is a consensus here? So maybe this is, so Sterl, they don't want to sign up to this, sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying I can make a chemically homogeneous model of any mass, and during the time they're evolving, they're not interacting, so why can't I make any masses in any binary? And the answer is I can. But what she's saying, I believe, is that they wouldn't merge in a Hubble time, and that's the problem.
There's another mic here. Do you want to pass the mic?
So yeah, that's the thing. If you want them to merge, they need to be pretty close right from the beginning. And that means that you would expect them to be tidally locked. So the mass ratio is important there, because you would expect the more massive star to be rotating closer to its critical rotation than the other one that's deeper in its Roche lobe. I use this, in that sense, it's as simple as the population synthesis part. I use some very simple prescriptions in terms of what tidal locking comes from. But generally, these are so compact that you have a wide array of assumptions you can do, and you still get tidal locking. Well, usually it happens with any of these models that before dropping tidal locking, you actually drop chemically homogeneous evolution. So it would seem that at least for part of the evolution, the efficiency of tidal locking is not an uncertainty.
So I would just add a provocative point and just say that if you put a wide enough black hole binary, even at a interesting mass ratio, and dropped it in an HEN disk, the gas can harden that binary so that it will merge within a Hubble time. So there's a way out, essentially, for such a model.
Yeah, without HENs or gas right. or disks. Okay. Okay, right? But. Isolated vacuum, yeah. Vacuum. But, yeah, I have another question.
I think it's interesting that this is exactly what everyone worries about, is that we have to start, there are all these details and all these ways to get out, and every statement that it just...
So you have been...
That's why you wrote your top statement,
yeah.
I assume, because...
So, but... Yeah, but you have been arguing that the people... So I guess this, I'm redirecting the statement to you, or in that area of the room. That the chemical homogeneous evolution is in trouble for Boxing Day because of the lower mass. But I guess in your talk you said that there is a parameter that you FC, I don't remember what is the physics behind that, that you can vary that allows you to actually produce those systems. So. So if we find a lot of black holes of between 5 and 10 solar masses.
Yes, we can dial up the mixing.
Okay.
We haven't tried it, but I'm sure we'll find a solution. But but it would have consequences that we can test. I'm quite sure that it would overproduce nitrogen-rich stars. It would probably make too many parent stability supernova from this channel. So we're going to rule out chemically homogeneous evolution, not from binary black holes, I think, but from the just failed ones that do all kind of crazy EM explosions. That's where I think I will be.
But therefore, if we see a lot of, you know, 5 to 10 solar mass systems, then you would also sign up. No, mass.
There's a separate, there's a number 6.
Yeah. So then there is, 1.1, which is if we find a lot of, 5 to 10 solar mass binary black holes, then probably chemical inhomogeneous homogeneous evolution is in trouble.
All of this is in the context of being the dominant channel.
Yeah, the dominant channel, absolutely. Okay, well, let's go to 2.
Binaries, then, in the parent stability supernova gap, will parent stability supernova not be adjusted?
Because but the metallicity would have to be quite low. Less than 10%. So
Sandy, use the microphone.
Sorry. Yeah. If you turn the metallicity down to if you turn mass loss to zero, then a 75 solar mass star will collapse intact.
Okay, so how about 80?
Eighty would not work. Okay. And 100 would not. 100 would not work. I'm just saying the lower bound is not 60.
So what should the number be? 75.
It's metallicity dependent. Well, it's 52 for moderate metallicity. Or point one and above.
So
yeah, you'd have to have less than 1% solar metallicity,
right,
or you'd have to turn the mass loss rate.
Rather than the metallicity, is there a range which is forbidden for all metallicity?
Yes, 75 to 133.
Okay.
Maybe 80 to 130
is
the case. But that's without rotation. But there's a simpler range with that. No, it's approximately true with rotation as well. If they be changed slightly.
Well, is that a microphone?
Well, but I think this is something that will fall as well when we see a full distribution of this thing. So if there are plane stability supernovae independent of whether or not we can make them in these metal poor environments, we should see a depletion once we reach the peristability supernova regime. So I think we cannot escape that. If just the population just extends nicely and continuously into where peristability supernova are supposed to be, then I think that would be an issue for that.
Just a question for the LIGO people. So we measure TERPAS very well. We don't really care about programming. So how well can we actually expect to answer this question?
So on the total mass there at around 80, but still the error is going to be large. It's going to be 20-30%. Yeah. But
so I should point out, though, that for dynamics, of course, if you have, say, a black hole and then it can just accrete either through collisions or multiple mergers in a dynamical environment, then you can push them up above whatever you can push it above that. Well, no, I'm talking about actually filling up that mass gap in the center there.
Right, I understand. This is about
periscope. Oh, okay. Sorry.
If the spins are aligned, then obviously that's a loophole. Yeah. Found there.
Mm. 30%, okay. Within plus and minus, 20 degrees. So vacuum always. Okay. Right.
We have consensus on number two now?
Throwing out triples.
No triples. So I tick this box. Okay, number three then.
So that was my attempt to try to rule out sort of conventional models, and I guess again the numbers are adjustable, but basically a lot of the rate of total mass more than 100 solar masses was larger than about a quarter of the rate, bigger than 20. That looked to me that was pretty hard to arrange in most conventional models unless you had a diet at 100 solar masses for some of this.
you will have to sign that picture. Absolutely.
Rule out is strong, but it's not favored.
Yeah.
Without messing with IMF.
Assuming universal IMF, all right. Places, all times.
Okay, so without adjusting the
IMF. Okay.
That applies to everything. If you let us change the IMF, anyone can produce anything.
Yes. Tick. Okay.
So. The next one, Astrid should weigh in on around the question of how many low metallicity objects are not correlated or inside L star galaxies. One did it sort of one air box correlation. We found that almost all black hole mergers were correlated with L star spirals and therefore solar metallicity. Would you then give up on everything requiring low metallicities? Or is there enough low metallicity satellites associated with L star galaxies that merge into them that you can't actually learn anything from that?
So, as far as I know,
may actually have formed outside of our Milky Way and have merged into it over time. So, and
it's. Well, that's not the point. I'm saying
oh. No, but that means.
Right. The question is whether is most of the low metallicity mass in the universe correlated with L star Milky Way?
Most of the mass at low metallicity is actually in the galactic center, because most of the mass of everything is in the distant and the galactic center. But it does mean there's a that actual balance is.
But our masses are integrated over, if I think, 100 cubic megaparsec volume. Is most of the low metallicity stuff actually in the Milky Way or its halo, or is it in dwarf galaxies that are several megaparsecs and anything else? Right, because that's what the LIGO correlations could potentially tell you. So if most of the low metallicity stuff is far away from L star galaxies, then the correlation could tell you that yes, it's in the low. Whether it's low metallicity stuff, otherwise it's true.
Yes, I mean, if I were to reinforce this, 1 degree squared is still like 300
counts.
Yeah.
500 megaparsecs. Yeah, well, I mean,
they're
that was just the fold. So, yeah, you can get a little smaller.
10% less, you know, 30 galaxies starting to get.
But still, you do not have complete catalogs there. So, at 500 megaparsecs or so.
It's getting better.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not 2022, 24. I mean, let's talk about the next few years. Yeah, no, you're right. 26, okay.
They have a long delay, so they can be out of their site of formation at the time they merge. That's the problem. It's not like long JRBs.
Yeah.
But the kids are only going to get 200 parsecs.
I was thinking galaxy mergers, not kicking. Like, they form in a satellite and then end up in the...
Yeah, that's the question.
I think there will be a lot that end up where they were not formed. I mean, not a different location. I want to help you. I find about half-half. I'm sorry.
So what's an interesting question is what is that 50-50 dividing point? You kill all halos below a certain mass, right, or below a certain mass, right? So what is that 50-50 dividing line between sort of old formation time, right? Just using a simple math simulation. I think this is a knowable.
So I think if extragalactic astronomers confirm that low metallicity objects are in low metallicity galaxies.
Yeah, and star formation in dwarfs and that type
of
thing.
This sort of brings me also to this question of connections between these systems and the gamma ray bursts. So for instance, you're discussing homogeneous evolution reasons fairly rapidly black hole. So they're all making gamma ray bursts, and we can't overproduce the gamma ray bursts too. So there's a rate that comes, I think the local GRB rate is like 0.3 measured per gigaparsec cube per year. You have to multiply by the beaming, which we don't know, but could be a factor of 100 or 10 or 1,000. So you don't want to overproduce that. So taking 0.3 times 100, that's already 30. So it's already sort of getting close to the observed binary black hole rate. So that's sort of another angle on this. Because I don't know what, obviously, there are potentially more channels to make GRBs than just the ones that happen to produce merging black holes. So.
I guess there is a prediction, though, I suppose you could say chemical homogeneous black hole might then naively say produce rapidly rotation, it would predict a significant fraction of the convention associated with the fourth of the GRB potential.
Yeah. So I think
if the chemical homogeneous evolution produces rapidly rotating stars, then they collapse. They don't collapse completely to black holes. They make a collapsar, and if that inevitably corresponds to a GRB, then the rates are such that you're explaining a significant fraction of all GRBs by this channel, and therefore a significant fraction of the LIGO event should have GRB jets that will produce radio episodes.
It may be produced by the same channel, but not made the same way. It's easy years later. You can make a gamma ray burst out of gravitational radiation source out of a single star.
It's just that the total number density would have to, in the post galaxy correlations and so on, would have to be consistent.
And also, as well, you have that for production of GRBs, you see them happening at pretty high metallicities as well. I think half solar or something like that, or quarter solar. So, I mean, if you would like to push to this very low metallicities that the current models would need to have, then it doesn't match the threshold metallicities you see for GRBs.
Is that a problem for your model then?
Well, it falls in the same other category that, there needs not be the only answer.
Yeah,
Yeah.
But maybe not only GRBs are interesting, but ULXs as well. So ULXs are just direct previous step, and they're sitting in metal poor regions and star forming galaxies. They're sitting slightly offset of star clusters, and they're in contact, obviously, because they accrete. So therefore, maybe statistics should be not compared so much with GRBs, which are presumably could go through single star shell, but rather with ULXs and with ULX metallicity dependence and star formation rate dependence.
Yes, I mean these are things that we can relate to the point of to the region where the things are formed, so the environment where they are formed, and not this giga years later place where they actually merge. So well, you have possibly ULXs because you're forming these very massive black holes. But you have, well, the gamma ray burst and also the possibility of peri-instability supernova. So there might be the possibility of combining all these things together and getting a consistent picture.
I have a feeling I'm starting to give part of my talk for tomorrow already. But let me perhaps add to the list. I think the distribution of Kerr parameters is extremely interesting with regard to the gamma ray burst. There's two and only two models for gamma ray bursts. One's collapsar, one's millisecond magnetar. The collapsar, the weak part of it is it requires enormous angular momentum, enough angular momentum to make a black hole with a Kerr parameter of around a half or so. And so gamma ray bursts are a very small fraction of supernovae, tenths of a percent, but the ones that make gamma ray bursts need to have that much angular momentum. And if you found only things with A of 0.01, it would tend to suggest magnetars more than collapsars.
So Kerr parameter GRB.
Yeah, so let's say this is 6.
But at 0.5 is the...
Okay. So exclude essentially the point. So what is the lower bound?
The discovery some black holes with masses, 10 to 30 solar masses, just to say a number, with Kerr parameters of a half, would be very supportive of the collapsar model.
Okay.
You could say that sometimes you get there.
Shall we talk about 5? Yeah. Oh yeah, vacuum is clearly with gas we've discovered that you can fix a lot of problems. Yeah, no, that's. One, two, three.
Before full-heartedly agreeing to the questions one, two, three, I think they have been a little bit ill-posed. On the blackboard is written if LIGO finds A or few. Stirl has actually said if LIGO finds tons of. These are actually two different questions and have two different consequences. So just like in number two, if we find a few, this may tell us something. There is something more than PISN theory. Yeah? But
there
if we find
several,
yeah, but it will not falsify it. Yeah, but if we find tons of some of these things, it may be a real problem. Yeah, so these are two different levels.
So then maybe, probably we need to wrap up, I don't know. So the question is whether there is something we should be doing that we aren't doing. I mean, clearly, I mean, we need to look seriously for high mass black holes, and this is happening.
I think there is one more group of things we should think about, which is what we can do with non-gravitational wave astronomy with classical electromagnetic astronomy, and this bounds on this rates or comparisons with ULXs. So within each of the scenarios, we should be looking for objects that preceded the formation of compact object binaries, and these objects should be around us. So we should identify these objects, and we should look for them and make sure that they exist.
Just follow up on your comment. In the next, I hope, within a year, there will be a big X-ray survey mission, which is called ERA-ZTAR. So it's German-Russian, and they will map the whole sky. First time after ROSAT, which ended in the 90s. But the comparison, step forward compared to ROSAT will be, of course, it will be more depth, and it will be also harder. So ROSAT was pretty soft. So I think that after ERA-ZTAR surveys are published, we will have really good statistics on accreting black holes, stellar mass accreting black holes.
Like in this classical scenario, we should be seeing binaries consisting of Wolf-Rayet stars and massive black holes, and they should be pretty bright.
So essentially, what you're saying is that we should, and maybe this is for a different discussion, think about what are the, you know, observational proposals for, you know, telescope time that people should put in the next few years in order to try to limit what are all the knobs.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because I'm just after this meeting, I'm going to Chandra next decade meeting, and there will be panel on joint facilities and synergies with observations, and I'm SOC member of Chandra conference, so I would be just happy if legal people would say, oh, we want some mega super duper second in X-rays. I think Chandra may favorably listen to it, so could be, you could think about it.
Yeah. Okay, so we should look for high mass black holes. Is there something else that we, apart from building a lot of LIGOs?
There is a subtlety about looking for Wolf-Rayet and black holes. You have to make sure that, you know, if you're looking in the galaxy, that the light times are long enough to expect to have more than one of them, which I think is a limitation for many of the interstable channels. Yes, I think, you know, looking for understanding
So I don't know if everyone heard. So what can we get from neutron star black hole? Would we be expecting LIGO to be detecting these mergers?
Well, yeah, but it depends on the rate at which.
Yeah. So I don't know. Considering the classical channel, so it's common envelope channel, what rates do you expect? Do you expect to see them with advanced LIGO, or?
I showed that the last slide was basically exactly that. It was the comparison between the measured upper limits and the predicted rates. And the neutron star, some of the neutron star black hole rates are actually kind of getting up close there.
Once you know the black hole rate, assuming that the field channel is dominant, how free then are you able to change the rates?
Which is kind of the opposite of what Star Trek is like, because people in Star Trek said, well, we know the double pulsar rate, so let's use that as a constraint. Well, now we know the binary black hole rate, so let's use that as a constraint.
Right. So that's the question I have, is how free are your neutron star black holes, which are just already now that.
So if by the end of 5 years of advanced LIGO design sensitivity, we haven't seen any black hole neutron star.
What's that? I did that, but that was a long time ago with old models. But I did work on constraints, and I can show you the plots from the older paper. So it's not up to date with what we have now. I mean, you need to do thousands of simulations. But
okay. Yeah, and we do things like, I mean, kicks. Yes. Yeah. So we can adjust.
Yeah, even then, if you play with those knobs and by the end of advanced LIGO we see nothing, is that a problem for common envelope evolution?
I think they are saying
so,
no.
So unfortunately, for what we have now, at the end of just advanced LIGO, it's not really a problem. Certainly not for O3.
I agree, this is not a problem, but this will be a very nice and strong constraint.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's going to be shaving off the upper optimistic side of it.
That's right.
So if I'm correct, the majority of the neutron stars in neutron star black hole, neutron star mergers in Star Trek, or the classical channel if you want, because that's the main predictions, are coming from things that are in the low mass end that are in the regime of the electron capture supernova. And so I think there's a really strong bias towards the roughly 1.4. And so if we would be detecting neutron stars, if just having deviations from that would be a very interesting constraint on the physics.
So you mean the mass of the neutron star? So that it is different from 1.4?
In the supernova theory world, there's other freedom and knobs to play with this. But at the moment, I think there's this really strong peak in the Star Trek simulations at 1.4. Because Chris almost hard-coded, no, that's not right, but that
no,
is low-mass
okay.
ones.
But I'm just saying
they
that
are completely dominating the ones that stay
yeah.
bound. And will
our error bar on that 1.4 is going to be sufficiently large. That is going to be between 1 and 2.5. Okay, so that's my.
So I was making the point because the question was just asked, knowing the black hole rate, what can we do on the neutron star rate? And so the simplest knob is indeed, do these low mass, so we have an idea what the kicks of neutron stars are, but the freedom is in, do the low mass neutron stars are the ones that potentially come from electron capture, do they have basically zero kicks or very low kicks? And that's a knob that completely is free and is completely dominating the rate predictions, I think, if I'm not.
To your point, Alberto, that you're not going to know the mass of the neutron star very well, but an electromagnetic counterpart definitely helps a lot.
Yeah. I mean, not usually, but sometimes some of the it depends on the rate. There are some cases where we can know if we can measure the mass.
This is a spectacular thing. I mean, the neutron star distribution is going to be peaked around 1.4. It's going to be between 1.2 and 2. And seeing one or two of them, I'm not sure it's going to tell you that much. But unlike the black holes, we know there's going to be, we think there's going to be counterparts there. There's the macro novae, and there are searches for those, and also short hard gamma ray bursts. And to see that see those three together is going to be one of the most exciting things that can be done.
I mean, one of the things that is going to help here is that for these systems, because they are less massive, we will detect them closer to us, and therefore finding a counterpart probably is going to be easier. But the error box is still going to be 100 square degrees. Yeah.
So I don't know if we have many EM observers here, but given the surface area that we can, of the sky area that we have now, how many kilonova-like things go off within the time window that you expect that could be false positives, given that that's the big sky looking? I knew Ido Berger has a student trying to do this empirically.
Yeah.
Well,
next week I can do the discussion, but I think we do know kind of the answer, and it's not very many, right?
But given two events, we already have one, right? Given two events, DES has already seen one thing that would have been fooled us into thinking it was a kilonova if it wasn't already confirmed as a supernova from PanSTARRS.
So we're doing this in the Dark Energy Survey. So
we both have four following up the LIGO events. There's one supernova that plateaued that looked like a kilonova, very unlucky, but it was in the field.
Right,
2P. Only because of that we happen to have observations from before. But that's right. So if we have PTF is good. That's right. But yes. That's right. So this is 3%. But of an old school LIGO error box, it'll get better. But also we're looking in the DES data, the actual year one and now year two data, looking for kilonovae. And so we get a much better sense of the false alarm rate. Now we're talking about hundreds of square degrees, many, many observations. And so there's a paper coming out shortly about that. But even there, we do okay. I mean, it's we can control it. It's mostly, it's type 1As. It's supernovae are your problem. And you've characterized them pretty well at this point. So I think there's hope.
You have a number of sources, and you can look in the infrared. You can potentially do if we have an infrared telescope that we can use for this. But there are ways if you can get it down to 10 or even 20 sources, you can follow them up and try to confirm them.
It needs a bit more work. I mean, if you can't tell the difference between something that's made out of lanthanum and made out of hydrogen, then your models need developing.
But over 50 square degrees, for every single object. That seems good. We're just in time for cookies. Cool. So
very good.
So thank you, Alberto.
So several people took pictures, and I'm...